This is a responsum of the Bach in Simon Mem Vav, in responsum 46 of the Shut Bach HaChadashot. It's from the 25th of Kislev of Shin Pei Gimel. Shin Pei Gimel is 1622, the fall of 1622, or maybe even the winter of 1622. And that's why I always jump on an opportunity to have the Bach be one of our respondents, because they didn't date all that many tshuvot back then. So we get an opportunity to expand our stable of respondents. We do so. And if any of that introduction was repetitive, I apologize. I taped, must have been 10 minutes, maybe more, and then realized I had hit the pause button and forgotten to turn it back on. But now, and that's why I keep checking, but now I'm pretty sure I'm recording. Okay, so he says, the question is, a man jumps up in front of a community and he swears that he's not going to forgive another man, not in this world and not in the next world. And that other man hadn't asked him for forgiveness. So the question is that considered a shvuat shav? Is that considered an oath with no meaning to it, no value to it, no essence to it? It's just a shvuah that has nothing to it, and therefore should we punish the man for taking a shvuat shav? The Bach says there's no punishment needed here. It's not a shvuat shav. A shvuat shav is when, or which he says is really means a shvuat chinam, a shvuah, an oath that has no meaning to it, is when somebody swears to a readily recognized fact. Right. So if it's a fact that's not well known, that might be a different thing. But he's swearing on a simple, plain fact. That pillar of stone, I swear that it's stone. Right. So those kinds of things are called a shvuat shav. They're a violation of the Torah. We're not allowed to take oaths that have no real value to them and are just, we're invoking the name of God and we're making an oath and there's no point to it. But, and this man had done it by grabbing a Sefer Torah as well, so he had given it all the forms of a very serious oath. But when he swears not to forgive his friend, and the assumption is in the tshuva, meaning the Bach says, and the reason why he swears such a thing is because he was worried that people would try to pressure him to forgive his friend. So, and that's why he swore not to. So that's a real oath because he's accomplishing something. He's telling people he's not going to forgive him, and I think he's probably thinking that'll stop them from trying to get him to forgive the other man. And so he's accomplishing something. So that's a fine oath. So where it might be a problem, though, says the Bach, is in another issue, and that other issue is that there's a principle in the Gemara of that we are all Jews, mushba'im ve'omdim me'har Sinai. We are all considered having taken an oath at Sinai to fulfill the Torah. So in halacha, if somebody takes an oath to then not do that, to fail to fulfill the Torah, that's considered an invalid oath. So you might think that this man has taken an oath, levatel et ha-mitzvah, to refrain from fulfilling a mitzvah. What mitzvah is he refraining from fulfilling? It would seem to be a mitzvah that if somebody comes to you for forgiveness, you have to forgive him. The Bach says the one exception to that is kishehotzi alav shemra. If somebody told tales about you, somebody spread either false or true maybe, but when they said bad things about you, I think it's probably false bad things about you, so that's the kind of thing where you might not be able to get your reputation back, you might be able to build it up again, and it might have lasting damage for you. There might be some room. The Bach seems to assume that there's room to say that the person doesn't have to forgive the person, but other than that, then you're not allowed to be Akhzar. You're not allowed to be. Akhzar is a word that we often translate as cruel, but I think a more accurate translation is probably insensitive, is probably lacking in the desire to be a good, kind person. So that's not necessarily cruel, right? To cruel, I think in English, when we say cruel, we think of things like, you know, chopping up worms for the fun of it, or torturing people, or causing other people pain for no good reason. Whereas this person, it might not be going that far. He might be just saying, I can't feel it my way to forgiving this person. They did something bad to me. It really hurts me. I don't see my way to forgiving them. So I think where Akhzar comes in is that there's a lack of sensitivity there. If the other person is really sincerely sorry and sincerely wants to make amends and wants to rectify the relationship, there's a lack of sensitivity to others. There's a lack of openness to others. And that's considered Akhzar, that coldness of heart, which doesn't have to lead to cruelty, right? You can have a coldness of heart and never do cruel things to other people, just not be nice to them, not be kind to them, not be open to them, create venues for interaction with them. So I think that's what Akhzar means. So therefore you might think that this person is taking an oath to become that kind of person, to be an Akhzar in the sense that they won't forgive this person, and you might think that that's against the Torah. So he doesn't step back from saying that it really is against the Torah, that really Jews are meant to be the kinds of people who, if somebody does wrong to us and then they sincerely want to make amends, that we find a way to help them make amends. Just as I say that, I want to be clear that, let's say, you know, they steal $1 million from us, they say, oh, I'm really, really sorry. it doesn't mean you don't have the right to get the money back. And if they've damaged you more than that $1 million, because there are all sorts of things that happened to you, there's all sorts of discussions that go on about how to make amends. Just because somebody says sorry doesn't mean that I have to then say, okay, it's all over. I don't mean that. But the idea that if somebody sincerely wants to rectify the damage that was done and recreate the relationship and renew the relationship, that we're supposed to be open to doing that, that that's a Torah idea and a Torah obligation that the Bach never steps back from. But what he points out is that when we come to the principle in halacha of Mushba ve'omid mahar Sinai, when it comes to the halachic principle that Jews are considered to have taken an oath at Har Sinai to observe the Torah, so to what does that apply? So there's a range of answers you give to that question, right? I could have imagined somebody saying, what it really means is the Jews took an oath to be good Jews, and anything that's included in properly observing Judaism and properly serving Hashem, as far as we today understand it in our times, you can't take an oath not to do such a thing, right? So if it became true that at some point in Jewish history, Jews decided that male Jews should wear kippot, should wear head coverings, at all times, let's say, or you know, and when it's comfortable to, or when they're not around non-Jews who might react, whatever the parameters of wearing a kippah, I could have imagined the halacha being, and you can't take an oath not to wear a kippah because it's part of being Jewish. That's not the principle as the Bach understands it. And I think the reason is that the Bach notices that the phrase Mushbamu made me Har Sinai, that we took an oath at Sinai, and therefore the Bach says all that's included in that halakhic principle is that which was expressly said at Sinai, meaning is expressly in the Torah, is explicit in the Torah. So if somebody were to swear, I'm not going to take a lulav, I'm not going to shake a lulav on Sukkot, that oath can't take effect, and that oath can't take effect because... that oath can't take effect because I took an oath at Sinai to follow the Torah. But even something that Chazal derived from the Torah, Midrash Chachamim. Now, it's important to remember the derivations. Chazal's derivations can often have a status of deoraita to them. They can have a status of being somewhat biblical. There's a whole discussion in the Rambam about what counts as one of the 613 mitzvot. But in terms of something being a halacha deoraita, a rule of Jewish law at a deoraita level for all the significant factors that go into the right level, that can be true even of things that Chazal derive from the Torah. Even so, says the Bach, even though that's true, he doesn't say that even so, that part I've added in just to give background, but even so, if it's derived by Chachamim, for all that its status may be very similar to the status of that which came expressly, a shvu'ah, an oath, will take effect. If somebody takes an oath, not that they should, but if they take an oath not to do that, that will take effect. That's what the Shuharan pointed out. Another factor, says the Bach, is that the Rosh pointed out another issue that comes up in halacha. Let's suppose a man's brother, sadly, passes away without children. This surviving brother now has the choices to whether to marry the widow. We today don't do this. That would be called yibum. Or to give her a chalitza, to perform a ceremony with a shoe and a spitting in front of a court, and then she could marry whoever she wanted to marry. Let's suppose that a man takes an oath that he's going to do chalitza and not yibum. He's going to do the shoe ceremony and not the yibum ceremony. Does that oath take effect? So the question, for example, would be, let's suppose that afterwards, for some reason, he decided he did want to marry her, and so he wants to yibum, but he's got this oath. Does that oath take effect such that, for as long as the oath is in effect, he cannot do yibum, he must do chalitza? So the Rosh says, so you might think that, well, isn't it an oath to be mevatel the mitzvah of yibum? Isn't it an oath to refrain from fulfilling the obligation to perform yibum? So the Rosh had said, no, it's not that way, because the Torah gave him the choice. So once it's a choice for him, even if the Torah, and the Gemara seems to think that in the Torah's time, the preference was for Yibum over Chalitza. We today prefer Chalitza over Yibum for reasons we don't have to get into right now. But in the Torah's time, so you might have thought, well, since the Torah prefers Yibum, then the oath shouldn't take effect. And the Rosh says, no, it's not true. The Torah gave the man the right to decide. Once he has the right to decide, then to swear to perform one version of the mitzvah as well as the other is not a bitul. It's not a negating of the obligation to fulfill the mitzvah. So here too, says the Bach, it is a mitzvah to forgive your friend, your colleague, your whoever hurt you, if they come for forgiveness. But the Torah gave the power of forgiveness to the person. It's his choice, meaning, so, you know, if somebody hurts me, or they damage me, whatever they do, and they come and they apologize completely and sincerely, so I'm not obligated from the Torah to forgive them. And that decision and that judgment as to what's going on and when is the right time to forgive and why to forgive and not forgive, or even just to be not the best person in the world and not forgive, the Torah left that up to me. Since the Torah left that up to me, it means that if somebody swears not to do it, according to the Bach, they are not swearing to not fulfill the Torah. So even if it was explicit in the Torah that we had to forgive our friends, the Bach is saying, nonetheless, an oath following the rush, he's suggesting that an oath not to do so wouldn't be a violation. It's a little more complicated because here he's swearing never to do so, and if there's a mitzvah to do so, it can't be that never to do so, but that's where the Bach has it. So that is a brief response with the Bach from the 25th of Kislev of Shin Pei Gimel of 1622 about whether an oath not to forgive one's friend is a shvuat shav, and it's not, because a shvuat shav is a shvuat that has no meaning to it, such as swearing that this, you know, these leather shoes are leather, this pillar of stone is stone, right? So that's a shvuat shav. The other possibility was that it would be considered a problem because you're being nishpal levatel a mitzvah. There the Bach gives two reasons why it's not. One is, I think the better one is, that it's not explicit in the Torah, and we can, and shvuot, oaths take effect when they're on matters that are not explicit in the Torah. And the second is the possibility that the Torah left it up to this person, and therefore it's not an issue. That is one response for our day. Since it's a brief response, but I really want to do it because it's from the Bach from so long ago, and we don't get a chance to do it, I'll offer another tshuva as well, and maybe a third if we get a time, chance to. So on the 25th of Kislev as well, from Hey Tufshin Tet, from the fall of 1948, right? There's Rav Uziel, the Rav Rashi, the Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel, in Biskei Uziel B'Shilot Hazman 37, has a letter. It's a heartbreaking letter, but it leads to the discussion of a halakhic issue that we don't often get a chance to discuss in this context. And I'm always also looking, you know, when I'm looking to randomize, I'm looking to take the choice out of my hand, I'm always afraid that I'm just gravitating to topics that I like. This happens to be a topic that I like, but it's a topic a little bit out of the mainstream, so we don't usually see it. So the question was about soap that the Nazis had made from the bones of the victims of the Holocaust who had been burnt. And then the story was that they made soap from that. Now, I looked it up in Wikipedia just because I realized I have no clue to how one makes soap. One would even, not that one ever should even contemplate it, but in the context of this tshuva, I tried to look up how you make soap, how could it be possible to make soap from human bodies. So the answer is it's not really so simple. It's not really so clearly possible to do so. And I'll get to this tshuva in just a second because Wikipedia said something not only about this tshuva that's very relevant to this tshuva as well. But fundamentally, it turns out that soap is a combination of something like lye or an alkali, something that has a very, very basic component to it, with fat, any kinds of fat. And that together creates this cleansing agent that can be soap. It puts them together. Some process called saponification, and they make soap. So theoretically, if you take human fat, you can make soap from it. But it's not so simple to do, it turns out. And there's rumors spread during the Holocaust. This rumor spread that there were these letters on some soap that the Nazis made during the war. There, so some of these soaps were marked with the Latin letters. So in the tshuva here, he reports the way the rumor spread among Jews that it was RJF, and that was for Reiner Yudischer Fetten. Pure Jewish soap. That was the rumor. The Wikipedia at least claims that that wasn't actually what the letter stood for. That first of all, it was not a J, it was an I, but that in Germanic letters, it wasn't so easy to tell the difference between them, so it was really an RIF, and it really meant like state soap, and it was like an inferior form of soap. It wasn't a good soap, but the Nazis were doing it, not having anything to do with Jews, they were doing it just because they were trying to save money on soap, so it wasn't a really good soap. But that's not really important for our tshuva. So the question was, if you come across such soaps, they wanted to know, do you have to bury them? And do they create tumat oel? Meaning, what is their status? Do they count halachically as corpses of Jews? So whether or not Wikipedia is right that, in fact, these weren't the soaps of made from Jewish bodies, which would be, I mean, I don't know if that would be nicer or better. I mean, it would be, at least, it would be one less mark against the Nazis. But it just gives us a chance to see this halakhic question. So you're thinking that his assumption is that these are being made from, sadly, from corpses of Jews. And the question was, these pieces of soap, do they need to be buried? And do they create too much ohel? And he asked Rav Uziel what he thinks about it. So he points out, Rav Uziel points out, that he had actually also been asked the question of whether a Kohen could be involved in bringing the ashes of these victims of the Holocaust to bury them in Eretz Yisrael. Right, so that's a very similar question. Here, these are the actual ashes, so that the soap question comes out. The question was, a Kohen is not allowed to willingly and purposely bring himself into contact with Tumat Mat, with the ritual impurity connected to corpses. So here you have a Kohen, and you have these ashes of these people. Are we allowed, are the Kohanim allowed to be involved and bring them to Eretz Yisrael? And Rav Uziel had Paskin that if you have the ashes of a person, of the ashes of a corpse, that had also been nitpazer, that had been spread out, meaning we're going to get to it, but theoretically, you could have a person who's burned, let's say, on a table of some sort, and all the ashes are right there together. So if all the ashes are right there together, that's a slightly different question. But where the ashes have been, where the victim has been burned and spread all over the place, so Uziel Paskin, that they're completely tahor, they don't retain the ritual impurity connected to corpses, and they don't create too much ohel, or even b'maga, or even with touch, meaning the Kohen is allowed to touch them and be involved with them. We're going to get to it in a second. He's going to say that you should bury them. We'll get to that. He's not saying you can just do whatever you want. You don't have to treat them as the remains of a person. He's just saying that halachically, the definition of what creates tumat ohel, what creates the ritual impurity connected to corpses, has gone away if the body was burned and if those ashes were then dispersed. So this rabbi had asked him the question again, so he says, I'm going to look into it one more time, and I look into it again, and he points out, we have a Mishnah in Ohalot that says, the ashes of people who were burned, Rabbi Eliezer says, there's a shear, there's a rove of them, but Chachamim say, nope, they're tahar. And so the question is, why? And this is especially a question because you might have thought, well, the body isn't there anymore, but the answer is that we think that even if somebody has, if a body has decomposed to the point that now there aren't even any bones left, there's just dust or dirt or something very similar to ashes, we halakhically still treat that completely as the remains of the person who had passed away. So why is this different? The Tiferet Yisrael asked that question in the Mishnah in Ohalot. Why is it that the ashes are different than if something has decomposed to the point that it creates certain dust? And the Tiferet Yisrael's answer was, Shani Rekev, Sheshalta Bo Koach Hamita Tfei Ba'atzamot. That if you have decomposed stuff, that is still going through all the process of death and the decomposition, right? That's part of the process of life. The way the life of a physical body works is they live, they pass away however they pass away, and then over time, the body decomposes. So whatever is part of that process, says Tiferet Yisrael, that will retain in it the tumah, the impurity, the halakha, the Torah ascribes to corpses will be retained in those things. But when it comes to something that was burned, so that's a product of a process that has nothing to do with death. Meaning, he doesn't, even if the person was burnt to death, his point is that the turning of, the conversion of the human body into ashes from a burning, that's not part of the natural process. And once it's not part of the natural process of decomposition, the halachic requirements of tuma, of ritual impurity, don't apply anymore. That's what it's very strong understands. That's what the Ruziel is going to understand. That's the way we understand Chacham's point of view. Chacham's point of view is, since it was changed from what it was by a process that had nothing to do with death, that already means that it doesn't have, it now like a new thing that's here, and this new thing that's here doesn't come with Tumat Ohel, with ritual impurity. The Rambam in the Parash Mishnah says something somewhat similar. He says, Kasher Nisraf, once it was burned, yatsa min hameitim, it's no longer a death thing. It's no longer connected to a corpse. So the meaning, the way the Rambam says it is, remember that in the Rambam's time, they believed in what's called the four-element theory. They believed that the components of it, what we call elements, are the smallest units of composition of society, of compositions of everything that can be made, right? So there are hydrogen atoms and oxygen atoms and carbon atoms, and all those atoms, you can go lower them. There are things called subatomic particles, but those subatomic particles don't have the characteristics of hydrogen or oxygen or carbon or magnesium or all those kinds of things. That theory is a more, it has its roots in the Greeks, but it's a more recent one in scientific thought than in the time of the Rambam. The time of the Rambam, the assumption was that everything in the world is made up of four things. It's made up of a combination of fire, earth, wind, fire, and water. Earth, wind, and fire got their name from that, but earth, wind, fire, and water. So the Rambam says, you know what fire does? Fire burns off the earth. Fire burns off the fire and the wind or the spirit and the water aspects of everything that there is in the world. And so that's all that left is earth, is ashes. We don't have to defend that perspective. I'm not saying that we should believe in that because the Rebbe has said it, but he uses it to explain that what's going on here, if you have a burnt corpse that leaves behind just ashes, what it means is that it has been removed from there is the fire, earth, and all that's left is the ashes. So you could say the ashes don't. Anyway, I don't want to get into it. But it's different than the Rekha, he says, because if the body just decomposed, then nobody destroyed the fire part of it, and the water part of it, and the spirit part of it. It wasn't destroyed and burned off or gotten rid of. It seems to have sort of decomposed into this new thing and this new composition of these things. But that's what the Rambam says it. So that retains its connection to the original body and all these kinds of things. And the Rav Uziel points out, the Rush says something similar, because the Rush says, it just doesn't have the same halacha as decomposed matter. So all of them are saying basically the same thing as what the Rav Uziel is pointing out, is that the act of burning takes this and sort of takes the body and turns it to something completely different in all of its ways, and therefore it doesn't have the same halachot. So, but says Rav Uziel, it's not clear that that would be true if what's called shlado kayemet, if the spine of the shape of the body was still there. That's not so clear. There's Yerushalmi that says Dvar Torah shlado kayemet Torah, but they said it was tummy because of Kvodo Shlomate, that maybe on a Torah level it really also is tahor. But if you have a full body there and that was burned, so then it looks too much like a person for us to just simply treat it as if it's not a person. Therefore, at a rabbinic level, that's the Yerushalmi. But in the Bavli, it just says that would be tummy. If you have a corpse that got burnt to death, it got burnt to death, even much of the skin was burnt off, and all you have left is a spine or some shape of the body is still there, it'll be tummy. So the Gemara there says, Hechi dami shlado kayemet. How do you define the shlado kayemet? They have a discussion there what it is and how much can be left. And one of the options is Ravina says, going to ichriche. It sort of got singed. So Rashi there says, it didn't get made fully into ashes. It got burned up, but it's not completely ash. So Abai and Rava think that if it got burned, that's not good enough to be mitahar. It has to be not only burned, but that it has to be scattered. And therefore, that's where Rav Uziel got this idea that it's got to be the ashes were scattered as well. Because if the ashes, according to Abai and Rava in that Gemara, if the ashes are still in their original place, that might be a version of what's considered shlado kayamet. I've been defining it as the spine is still there, but Rav Uziel is pointing out, you read the Bavli, the opinions of Abai and Rava would seem to mean that even if it's completely ash, as long as the ashes haven't been moved from where they were, let's say, you know, they strapped the guy down so they could burn it, whatever it is that happened, or, you know, it doesn't have to be so nefarious. Sadly, let's say it was in a house fire and they were lying in bed, and this happens, unfortunately, and sadly, there have been cases, right? And you come to the bed, and there in the bed is the person who was burnt. So, and the ashes are right there. So there, those kinds of things. Vazil is saying, he thinks there's sources in the Bible that say that at least on the Derabanan level, we are mitame it. We treat it as tameh because it's a lack of kavanah. It would be a lack of respect for those who have passed away to just treat it like it's nothing. So therefore, says Rav Uziel, if somebody got burned, if a person was burned and the ashes are where they were when the person got burned to death, that's considered shlodo kayam, that's going to be tameh. And Ravina thinks that no, that it's completely ash, it's already tahor. And his answer of shlodo kayemet is that it didn't get completely burned off and was made completely ash. So So that's where Uziel comes out, that the answer is that if the ashes have been scattered, you know, they then have lost their tumah. If the ashes are still all in the same place, he passes that you have to worry about the opinions of the Gemara that say that there's a tumah and a Kohen couldn't get involved. Now the person, the rabbi asking him the question, said, but maybe there's a difference between where they were killed and then burned, because once the person was killed, there was an idea of tumat mate there. So maybe if the Jews were killed in a gas chamber and then the bodies were burned in crematoria, as awfully happened in the time of the Shoah, in the time of the Holocaust, maybe there would be a retention of the tumat mate. Maybe the ritual impurity that came doesn't go away just through the process of burning. Maybe when the Gemara talks about ashes not having tumat mate, ashes not having the ritual impurity, that's where the person was burnt to death, and the process of being killed by burning is what gets rid of, because it prevents there ever being a tumat mate. So Rav Uziel says he doesn't think so, because if you look at the Tiferet Yisrael that we mentioned before, in terms of the reason is that something new is here. You took a person, and the fire process, the corpse, the remains of a person, and the corpse turned into something completely different, ashes. That would you have that Rambam as well, that you took away all the fire element of it, and the earth element, not the earth, I keep saying that, the fire element, the water element, and the spirit or the wind element of it. And it's also saying that it's the burning process. It doesn't really matter when the burning process. The burning process is taking away all these things. And therefore, Rav Uziel sticks with what he had said before. He thinks that this soap, and now we see why I said in the beginning, it's not really relevant whether or not it's true. His point is, anything that we have that is ashes of people who passed away, sadly do not have the status of tumat mate, of ritual impurity, such that Kohanim, I guess the leniency here is, Kohanim could be involved in this very holy task of taking these remains and bringing them to Eretz Yisrael for burial. That the burning process means that there's no tumat mate there. Then he points out that in another place he's written that if people voluntarily have themselves cremated, so interestingly, I prepare these response at different times. So I usually have like a 2-week delay between when I record one and then I find one for the next time. Meaning I try to be ahead not only in what I record, but I try to read them one time and excerpt them one time weeks before I'm going to get around to, about 2 weeks before I'm going to get around to recording them. And it gives me a chance to sort of see them over and over again, because when we see things a couple of times, we have insight that we might not have on the first time. So as it happens, the responsive that we'll see together in 2 weeks on the 10th of Tevet is completely about the issue of cremation, and Rav Kook was asked about it. So it's just, I've heard people speak about as if in 2012, 13, 14, 15, and 16 in the English calendar, that's when cremation is becoming an issue and we have to really worry about it. And I would just point out that already in the beginning of the 20th century, in Rav Kook's time, he was asked about it, and Rav Uziel was being asked about it in the middle of the 20th century. So unfortunately, this is a practice that comes up again and again, and too many Jews come to believe that it's okay. So he had been asked about whether or not you could bury people who are cremated, bury their ashes in a Jewish cemetery. And Rav Uziel had said he thinks not. He ruled against it. He ruled against it because these people who voluntarily have their remains cremated, he calls them Rishaim Gemurim, right? Calling people evildoers today and Rishaim today is a fraught thing to do. People don't like it. They don't like the terminology. They don't like to hear about it. So I'm not going to get into it. But his point is that in doing so, you're clearly denying resurrection of the dead. And in his understanding of the Gemara, and there's good reasons why you would understand it this way, but it's not our issue, that means you're denying not only resurrection of the dead, but you're denying future reward and punishment. Meaning, somebody gets themselves cremated, he's saying they may not, today, they may not even realize it, but what you're really doing is you're saying you don't really believe in the whole version of the afterlife that traditional Judaism posited and told us we have to believe in, which involved being buried, and one day those remains that were put into the ground coming back to life and then going on to their eternal reward or punishment. So therefore he had said, people like that we don't get involved with for various reasons that Rav Kook will tell us about in 2 weeks. We don't get involved with such people. We don't deal with them. We don't help them get buried. We don't get involved with such people because they've cremated themselves. So since he ruled that way, you might misunderstand his ruling to be anybody who's been burnt, any ash, we don't bury ashes in Jewish cemeteries, but he says that's not clearly not true. The ashes of the people who are, he calls them Kedoshei Elyon, or at the highest level of sanctity by virtue of being killed as Jews, and being killed as a Jew, not that we should want to have it happen, being killed as a Jew is an act of Kiddush Hashem. So the sanctity of a person was killed al Kiddush Hashem. So even if they were killed by burning, or if they were killed and then later burned, that those ashes are holy ashes, and they certainly need to be buried with all of the honor accorded any Jew who would be buried in a Jewish cemetery. And it will be a permanent reminder to us of what these terrible evildoers tried to do to our people and the abomination they did. And it will be an atonement for all the sins of the Jewish people, like Akedah Yitzchak, like we always, like we say at the end of Hazinu, Kidema Batav Yikom, and Akav Yishiv Lutzarev, and Kepirad Mato Amo, that should be a kapah for all of us. And that is Rav Uziel about the ashes of the people from the Holocaust, whether it doesn't have Tumat Mein, it does not have the ritual impurity that usually comes with being a corpse, but it does have full sanctity in contrast to those who cremate themselves, who have themselves cremated, where they would not be buried in a Jewish cemetery. These, for sure, should and will be buried in Jewish cemeteries with all the honor and all the respect due any other Jew as well, or even more so, since these are people who passed away, al kiddush Hashem. And that is, those are two responses a day for the 25th of Kislev. Have a great day.